So then what? What I'm saying is we're kind of walking through the progress of where we've been. We talked about the rapture, which is followed by the judgment seat of Christ in heaven during the tribulation period, as well as the marriage of the Lamb, and then the marriage supper of the Lamb. So that kind of covered a lot. That took us through some things in heaven during the tribulation period, and the marriage supper happens in the beginning of the kingdom. So now we're going back, though, starting kind of again from the rapture. What comes after the rapture? The tribulation. So we're going to start talking about that this evening. One of the key passages that comes to mind is the tribulation is a 7-year period, a week of years. And so we go to Daniel 9 to kind of get some of that timing worked out. Daniel is praying in Daniel chapter 9. He's asking God, what's going on? He's been reading in Jeremiah that the captivity, they'd be sent off into captivity for 70 years. And he thinks it through and he says, wow, we're getting close to 70 years. Lord, what is the plan? And the Lord reveals to him the big plan. Not just the 70 years of captivity and then restoration to the land, but 70 times 7 for all of his plan for Israel. And so God reveals it's going to be a 70 weeks or years or 490 years. And we'll talk about that. So here's what it says in Daniel chapter 9, verse 24. 70 weeks, 70 sevens literally, are determined for your people. Again, the context is the 70 years. So he's saying 70 sevens are determined for your people and for the city. During that time, it's going to finish transgression, make an end of sins, make reconciliation for iniquity, bring in everlasting righteousness. Know therefore and understand, from the going forth of the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, until the Messiah, the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. And then that will lead to the rebuilding of Jerusalem. And they're in captivity. Jerusalem's destroyed. So he said the start of this 490 years is at the rebuilding, the command to rebuild the city. There'll be 62 years and 7 years. 62 is 434 years. Messiah is to come. Messiah will be cut off after 62 plus 7 years. The city will be destroyed by the people of the prince who is to come. After the 62 weeks. So, there's going to be 7 and 62. After the 62 weeks, Messiah will be cut off, not for himself, and the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. So, from the decree to 69 times 7, there's going to be, then the Messiah will be cut off, which assumes he has arrived. He is cut off, and what does that mean? That's a sign, that's a biblical expression for judgment. He comes under judgment, but not for his sin. And the people of the prince who is to come, that's, we'll talk about him later, that's the Antichrist, is going to destroy the city and the sanctuary or the temple. So there's going to be a decree, there's going to be a rebuilding of the city, we were told at the start. And then we're told in 62 plus 7, 70, 62 plus 7, 7 years, there's going to be the cutting off of Messiah and destruction of the city again. This prince that's described will confirm a covenant with the many for 1 week. In the middle of the week, he'll bring an end to sacrifice and offering. So that's kind of laying out God's program to Daniel for Israel. It's a 490-year program. At the end of 483 of those years, Messiah is cut off. The city will be destroyed after that. Messiah comes and he dies and resurrected 30 or 33 AD. AD 70, the temple's destroyed. So in this period, we're kind of, the clock is stopped. When Messiah was cut off, that kind of stopped and put on hold God's program for Israel. Then the city's destroyed. that last final 7 years is coming when a prince will arise and inaugurate a covenant that will restore sacrifices, which means the temple must be restored. Does that make sense? No. Well, let's look at, if I could put it graphically. Last 7 years starts with a covenant. The covenant's broken in the middle of that 7 years. The temple is desecrated. And that's when what's called the Great Tribulation begins. Let's look at Daniel's 70 weeks. So he said there's going to be 490 years. 7 and 62 and 1 week. So the first 69 years, he says 70 weeks are determined for your people and your holy city. It starts with a decree to rebuild Jerusalem. That decree would be March 5th, 444 B.C. by Artaxerxes. We see that in Nehemiah chapter 2. So 69, so that's 483 years after that is when the next thing is a key. After the 62, so 7 plus 62, Messiah is cut off. That's the crucifixion of Christ. After the 62 weeks, Messiah is cut off. So 7 and then 62. So we're now at 69 of the 7 years. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now we skip 40 years past the time of Jesus when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem and the temple. So we're now kind of, this is the period of the pause until the final 7 years begins. So it's sort of like saying you have 2 hours to take this exam. You go into it an hour and a half and they say, pause. Now you get a 5 minute break. Come back in and we start the clock again. So the 5 minutes doesn't count. That's kind of a pause. So after the 483 years of God's program for Israel, he hits the pause button. I want to make sure I haven't hit the pause button on the recorder. He hits the pause button. During that time, the temple is destroyed and the city is destroyed by the Romans in AD 70. But there's coming a final 7 years, so we're in that pause phase to finish off God's program for Israel. The whole point is, that's when the focus is on Israel. We're in what the Bible calls now the time of the Gentiles, where the Gentiles are the dominant world focus. Does that help any? Because he's talking in terms of sevens. And so Israel, here's how it starts. Jeremiah said God was going to send the people into captivity for 70 years. Why? Because the people didn't observe the Sabbath year. So they were supposed to observe a Sabbath day, don't work on Sabbath day. And every seventh year, they were not supposed to work. You don't till, you don't plant. You live on what's available, fruits and that sort of thing. Israel never did that. And so God counted those up and said, all right, I'm going to give the land a rest for all those weeks of years that you violated things. I'm sending you off into captivity, and they'll get 70 years of Sabbath. You're not going to work the land for 70 years to make up for the 70 sevens where they didn't observe the Sabbath year. So then he comes back and says, now there's another 77s coming. That will start from the beginning of the rebuilding of the city, the decree, to when Messiah's cut off. Then they'll be on pause, and there'll be one that'll be focusing on the Gentiles. And then, at the end of that, I'll bring a one final 7 year period. Yeah, that's the key, is understanding that Daniel was looking at Jeremiah and why the captivity was, as long as it was built on 77s. And so that's why we know, it's talking about years, not weeks, months, whatever.
There's a British astronomer, Sir something, forget his name, he wrote a book called The Coming Prince.
Anderson.
Yeah.
Sir Robert
Anderson.
Okay.
And he calculated, studied it for years, I guess. guess something I calculated the number of years, taking into consideration the, you know, we had 365 days in our calendar, they had 360.
And Sir Robert Anderson, he also worked for, I don't know about being an astronomer, but he worked for Scotland Yard as well.
Scotland Yard.
And so he was a very careful student of scripture and history. And so he calculated it out, as I recall, to almost to the minute, either the crucifixion or Palm Sunday is the filling that out. Another one who's done it, kind of taking a slightly different angle, but coming off very similar timing, is Harold Holder from Dallas Seminary, Chronological Aspects of the Life of Christ. But if you do the math and follow up, and that's frankly, I've never sat down and worked through. You know, you've got to know about calendars and all those kind of things, and I've never quite worked that all out. So, but that's where they land in the 483 years, right there at the time of the death of Christ. Besides cut off. Now, we're in the pause. 40 years later, wrong. Okay.
This is a challenging passage. This little four or five verses is difficult. So, Prince, to destroy the city. Then there's coming a period. Then he, who's he? The prince of the people who destroyed the city. He will confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. That's, by the way, those are just the Bible verses there. So there's the 7 years. But in the middle of the year, week, the 3.5 years in, he will bring an end to sacrifice and offering. So if he stops sacrifices at the midpoint of the tribulation, what does that tell me was going on in the first part of the tribulation? Sacrifices. You can't have sacrifices without the temple, or at least the altar and the full control of the Temple Mount. So what that suggests to me is either the temple is rebuilt, but right now where the temple is supposed to go is what's called the Dome of the Rock. And do you know what's under the Dome of the Rock? A rock, yes. That's very important to understand. The tradition is the rock, in Jewish tradition, that's the rock where Abraham offered Isaac. In Muslim tradition, that's the rock where Muhammad, in a dream, came from Babylon or Iraq, came on a stallion and lifted off from there into the heavens. So they both see it as important, but that's where the temple has to go. How is that going to happen? It seems to me that this is this incredible man who works it out, where full control is given over to the Jews so they can build their temple and have sacrifices. But then he takes over. After they have built the temple, he then takes it over for worship of himself. So but Daniel kind of gets an overview of that in these. So there's the picture of how the tribulation fits in. You'll notice the weeks are not to scale, okay? But that's kind of the picture of what's going on. We're going to fill that in the coming days. A key figure. It all begins with the establishment of a covenant by this prince of the people who destroyed the city. So let's talk about this Antichrist, who's kind of important to the whole issue of the tribulation. Now, what's important about the Antichrist is that he is a world leader. And so once again, we have to go back to the book of Daniel and think about it. Now, Daniel, Revelation, I admit, are some of the harder books to read through. It's not too hard to read through the book of Ruth and follow the story. Daniel, Revelation, a little more tricky. In Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the Babylonians, a great world leader. Saddam Hussein's ambition was to be the second Nebuchadnezzar. But he was a great world leader, conquered vast areas. He had a dream, and Daniel interpreted. I won't give the full story, but Daniel interpreted the dream for him. If you look there, that image, he saw an image. But what's odd about the image is that it had different metals. And Daniel explained that this image is kind of, God is telling Nebuchadnezzar, I was about to call him Saddam, God is telling Nebuchadnezzar what's going to happen in history. And he lays it out in a masterful way. So he says there's a golden head to that image. That's you, the great Babylonian Empire. Then it's to be followed by the arms and shoulders of silver. The fact that it's two arms is indicative of the fact that it's a kind of a confederacy of two nations. The Medo-Persians are the next empire. Now, he doesn't name them, but he just says, here comes another empire. That'll be followed by the belly and thighs of bronze, and that will represent Greece. And then it's followed by iron. That's Rome. And the last part is a mixture of iron and clay and the feet of 10 inches. Finally, a stone comes out of heaven, smashes into the feet of that, destroys that image, and a mountain grows. That's the kingdom of God. The point, one thing to notice, is there is something of a continuity. The Babylonians were conquered by the Medo-Persians. The Medo-Persians were conquered by the Greeks. Do you remember who was leading the world conquest of the Greeks? Alexander the Great. The Greeks were conquered by the Romans. The Romans just kind of just whimperingly went away. You know, a lot of people say, when were they conquered? When did the Roman Empire end? You know, it's very hard to determine exactly when you could say it, because they weren't in the same way conquered and replaced by another empire. But then the kingdom of God comes out of heaven. It's not a continuation. It is totally forward and after that. So the kingdom comes when Christ returns. That's world history. In Daniel chapter 7, the same world history is repeated in four beasts. The Babylonian Empire, the Persian Empire, the Greek Empire is by leopards. One of the things that that was amazing about Alexander the Great was how quickly he conquered. It's kind of like Hitler and his Blitzkrieg, lightning war, that he changed warfare and how quickly he could move and conquer. Alexander the Great did that in his day. So the leopard is appropriate. It's a four-headed leopard. Because when Alexander died, his kingdom was divided up between four of his generals. And so this is so perfectly fitting. Like the bear that's actually lopsided. One side is stronger than the other. The Persians were the dominant part of that team. But in fact, it's two-sided. Everything about this, historians read that and say, that is describing the Babylonian, the Medo-Persian, the Greek and Roman empires. What's the problem is that Daniel is writing that in the Babylonian period. He so perfectly describes the following empires that unbelievers are forced to say, how did he do that? Let's start with an assumption. There is no such thing as supernatural revelation. So if we take God and prophecy out, how do you explain that? What they end up saying is the book of Daniel is sort of a forgery. It's a guy writing, claiming to be Daniel, predicting the future, but he's writing after it's already happened. That's how the liberals end up doing it. It doesn't work with the manuscript evidence. It doesn't work with the linguistic evidence. We won't get into all that, but that's the main point is, their very criticism of it is actually kind of an endorsement of how accurate Daniel's prophecy is. He maps out the world history before it happens, right up to the end when Christ comes and establishes his kingdom.
So
this little chart you have describes the two empires. How they're represented and what the empire is. You'll notice in the chart I have there the feet of iron and clay. Now that becomes a problem. Iron is strong,
but you start mixing it with clay, and it becomes brittle and not so strong. And so that's kind of showing at the end time, the final world empire is going to be a not so unified union. It's going to be a weakened situation, but it's sort of in that it's attached to those same legs, and it's also of iron. It's really like a continuation or a restoration of the Roman Empire. And that's why I call it Rome 2.0. You know, you're always getting, you know, do you have the most current software? 0.5, 1.0, 59. I get this notice today, you know, well, you need to update your software. Version 59.64445 is out, and you only have 69.444, whatever. So I don't panic too much, but Rome 2.0, it'll be a renewed, restored Roman Empire. And that tells us, therefore, coming from basically the same people group and same region as the original Roman Empire. And so most people say the best way to describe that is Europe, by our modern way of thinking.
How are we doing? This is all kind of introduction. Make sense? And how many have heard, would recognize that you've heard something of this before?
How many think they could recite this stuff without me telling them right now? Again, I want to always remind you, when I finished seminary and the first time I had to preach a prophetic book, and I took prophecy from Dr. Walvoord, and I had all these books, and I studied under Pentecost and Walvoord, I still had to sit down and really work. Let me think it through. Let me think, how does this all fit together? And so that's why, you know, you hear it, and it helps you kind of get the big picture and you know, see how it all fits together.
But if you're struggling, don't let that bother you. I think one reason a lot of people stay away from prophecy is it takes so much work of putting things together. It's kind of like that lady that was talking on the testimony we showed you the video. One of the things for her as a Jewish person that was so exciting is she saw how Old Testament and New Testament fit together. And the more she saw that, the more she realized, hey, these are not enemies. This is one message. And so, but that putting together can be a challenge. Well, we're going to get into more depth now. There were these four beasts that Daniel saw. The fourth beast, or in Daniel chapter 7, where it said this, after this, in the night visions, behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. There's that word iron again, like Rome. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Okay, so here comes this beast with 10 horns. There he is. Can you count those? I didn't even count. Is that all 10 there?
Yes.
Those 10 horns are important. The 10 horns, which you saw an angel is explaining to Daniel, are 10 kings. Okay, so this is symbolic. The horns represent, okay, here's a future world empire. There'll be 10 rulers of this final empire. They've received no kingdom as yet. Okay, they're not here yet. But they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them. Did you see it? Watch carefully. I saw one of you looking down. You got it? One more time. I worked hard to make that work. There it is. A little horn appeared. So now how many? Okay. One of you two guys right here in front.
We had 10 horns, and a new horn appeared. How many horns do we have now? Right.
These guys are good. I didn't see a calculator. I didn't see a slide rule. That was good. Okay. I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. Now how many do we have?
Eight.
Excellent. 10 plus 1 minus 3. And you wonder, why do I have to study math? Okay, this is important. So what what that suggests is, okay, the horns represented what?
Rulers
or kings. So this one that came up, this new one that came up, I don't know if you want to call it a coup or something, but he basically took out three of the kings. Maybe replaced them, but we see him, we see kind of a lesser figure coming along and disrupting and taking control. I was considering the horns. There was this little one. There, in this little horn, were eyes like the eyes of a man. You see them? And a mouth speaking pompous words. What does pompous mean? Give me another word for pompous.
Proud.
Arrogant, yeah. So he's boastful. So here comes, this is a key element. Here were these 10 kings and three are gone. This little one is the key figure. And now we start seeing, that he's even more animated. We can see his eyes. We can see he's boasting and proud and arrogant. Now, when I think of the Antichrist, if you're a historian, you might think of one of the heirs of Alexander the Great, kind of an early picture of the Antichrist, and he's described in Daniel, is Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus IV. He was a vile, wicked Greek ruler. But to me, in modern terms, I think of Adolf Hitler. He kind of came up out of nowhere. Some people, what was his first area of study and work? He was an artist, right? And then, what was his rank in World War I? He was a corporal. Now, nothing against serving as a corporal, but, when he came along and he started eventually barking orders to all these generals, that was hard for some of them. They'd been career, they were generals, and who is this little corporal with no real education? He was an artist, a corporal. But boy, was he boastful. He had a mouth that was boastful and also powerful. He persuaded a vast number of a well-educated and cultured people to follow him.
Well, we'll talk maybe more about that, but here, notice, so this personality comes up, eyes like the eyes of a man, a mouth speaking pompous words.
This is the figure we call the Antichrist. He has various labels throughout Scripture. The prince who is to come, Daniel said. King who does as he pleases, Daniel 11. Man of destruction, in 2 Thessalonians 2:3. The lawless one. Beast out of the sea, or the Antichrist. That's the label we often put on him. And that is really works for him. The word anti can mean two things in Greek. When I think of anti, it means against, right? Did they even talk about it? Well, I remember when I was in grade school, they used to say a really cool, long word was anti-disestablishmentarianism. Did you guys ever hear that?
Yeah, it's the longest word in the dictionary.
Yeah, it is. The longest word in the dictionary, at least in the English. Now, the Germans, their longest word is probably 4 pages long.
Yeah.
But they cheat. They just combine words. But anyway, he's someone who's anti-establishmentarianism. He's opposed to it. So it's like pro and con, being against. But in the Greek, so it can mean against, but it can also mean instead of. This is the anti-battery that's going to replace the bad battery. I don't know if they actually say that in Greek, but the point is it can mean a replacement instead of. So Christ died anti us, in our place. So that one anti can mean either against or instead of. Okay? Make sense?
How you doing?
So the Antichrist is both. This Antichrist is opposed to Christ, and he's trying to replace him and imitate him. So Antichrist is a great label for who he is.
And you can think about a lot of things that Christ did that he did. I may have something on that. Let's talk about the character of the Antichrist. So, why is he important? The tribulation starts with the Antichrist coming on the scene. What does he do? He establishes this covenant of peace. Okay, I'm not going to in any way say that President Trump is the Antichrist. But I was struck when he was, I guess he'd become president. He went to Jerusalem, and I think I've shown you a picture. It just stunned me. I saw it there on the web. He had his hand, and I guess he was praying or something at the Western Wall, which is, you know, the outer wall of the that surrounded the Temple Mount. It's close as you can get to the temple, in a sense. The closest the remnants of it. There he is praying. And there was a caption in Hebrew, Shalom. He came to bring peace in Jerusalem at the place of the temple. And I thought, I'm not saying he's the Antichrist, but I thought, that's a picture of what the day is coming. When there'll be a man who will be on the Temple Mount, maybe helping to dedicate the temple, and everybody agrees. You could not get the Jews and Arabs in Israel right now to agree what day of the week it is. Just as a matter of principle, they're going to do. So this guy's going to come and he's going to bring peace. Well, or another example, I'm not saying he's the Antichrist, but notice how the world got all excited when he comes on the scene, and all of a sudden, North and South Korea are meeting, talking about setting aside, finally, you know, we've technically been at war since the war started in 1950. North Korea is talking about giving up its nuclear stuff. Okay. I don't know, but they had a terrible catastrophe in their testing center that it's like saying, I just crashed my car. Okay, I'll give it to you. But anyway, I'm surprised the world isn't more accepting. Well, the president of South Korea said President Trump should get the Nobel Prize. So here's my point. This world leader is going to come along that's going to make... I always thought, as a matter of fact, when President Trump was running, I didn't know that much about him. I never watched the TV shows he did or anything. But he wrote a book, The Art of the Deal. That's exactly what Antichrist is going to be known for. I'm not saying Trump is the Antichrist. But here's the point. That's a picture. Of course, many in the press hate him, right? The day is going to come when the whole world will surround him and say, dealmaker, peacemaker. He could pull it off in Jerusalem. We can follow this guy. Okay, so he's going to come out kind of like a Hitler, a little corporal, an art student. An art student couldn't make any money. And you know what he did? He put Germany back on its feet economically. He brought the industries back. He brought their economy back. He brought their pride back. And he almost conquered the world. So that's a picture of the Antichrist, who's going to be incredibly persuasive. And we'll show that some of this. But he's a coming world leader who is going to bring peace in a way the whole world will be astonished. How can you not trust this guy? Look what he has brought. He has brought peace. So, here are some of his characteristics. So why are we talking about him? We've already seen he's arrogant. He has a pompous mouth. He'll be boastful and proud. He will be sinful. He's a man of lawlessness. He'll be a wicked man. He'll be an immoral man. Matter of fact, I'm not sure entirely, but it says he will give up the love of women. He'll be ungodly. He will reject the gods of his fathers. Now, I'm not sure what these are. Most of these are coming out of Daniel. I'm not sure exactly. Some people want to say he's Jewish. I don't think so. I think he's a Gentile. But apparently, in other words, he is going to reject whatever his religious background was. So maybe he's coming up out of Europe and he's coming from a Catholic or a Protestant background. He might reject that. or he might be coming from some other category, but he is going to reject his religious heritage. By the way, do you see a lot of that in the day, in our day, where young people are coming up and saying, rejecting the idea of religion? He'll be hateful. He will be demonic. He will be inspired by Satan. He's going to have winsome words. He will have a mouth speaking great things. He will not have a perfect command and flow of language. His oratory will not only gain attention, but command respect. Revelation 13:2 declares his mouth is as a mouth of a lion. Majesty and awe. You know, when you think of a lion, have you ever heard a lion roar? They can be kind of chilling. And your first thing is, I hope that thing's in a cage. And there's something about a lion's roar. And if you were out, to me, if you were out in the plains of Africa, and you heard that lion, that would be, to me, very scary. But it is a voice of power and a voice of majesty. He's going to be an incredibly effective speaker. And again, I have to think of Hitler. Now, I can pick up a couple of the words of the German that he's using sometimes. But most of the time, but have you ever seen videos of him? And I look at that and think, that somehow I wouldn't follow this guy. You know, he just seems crazy up there.
He does.
Yeah. But then you look out, don't you? And you see the masses that were listening to him and following him. You know, there were lots of factors there. For example, I recently read about life in Germany in the early 30s. He'd risen up to the time where he was, chancellor. And they would have marches, like Memorial Day is coming up. They would have marched through the city. When that came through, if you didn't give the Hitler salute, Heil Hitler, you would probably be beaten up seriously by the brown shirt thugs that were going along. So if they looked around and they saw someone not giving the Heil Hitler, they would come around and beat you silly. Now, it actually became an issue because if I'm an American, should I be saying Heil Hitler? Would I salute another flag? So Americans wouldn't, but they didn't know if they were Americans or not, so that became an ongoing issue. They kept beating up Americans, hospitalizing them, because they didn't give the Heil. So sometimes the crowds were quick to say Heil Hitler, because if you didn't, you would be hurt. But the point was, he persuaded a nation to follow. He was a master.
He was a master of deception. He was a master, and so the Antichrist will be like that too. A great politician and diplomat.
Hitler was incredibly effective. And one thing he was very effective at was lying. He would make very bold and passionate promises. People would say, Hitler has promised us this is the last country he's going to conquer. He has promised he'll never go to war with Russia. He has promised, and people would believe him, and then he would come and attack them. So he was very effective in his dealings with things through deceit, diplomacy, persuasive. Hitler, and again, just as an illustration, he was a great leader economically, militarily, politically. Hitler made a lot of stupid mistakes the Antichrist won't make. So he will be militarily powerful. He will be politically astute. He will gain control of the economy. So what that suggests is, for someone like this to rise, Hitler rose to power, and I'm probably putting too much weight on Hitler as an example, but Hitler rose to power in the days of great crisis. Germany was bankrupt. The world was unstable. There was a lot of things going on. He seized on that and offered hope, and the people followed him. The Antichrist will come up like that too. Now think about, when does the Antichrist rise into the public view?
Sometime after the rapture.
So think about this. A lot of people say, will people know that the rapture is happening?
they'll know people are gone, right? Kind of like when we talked about in Sunday morning service last week, when Enoch departed, I'm sure people noticed. Where did he go? Where did he go? Can you imagine when all the Christians in the world are gone? All 300? No. However many it is, it'll be noticeable and might be disruptive. And so someone that could come along and calm people and have answers, then later on there's going to be the battle of Gog and Magog, and I think that will really seal his influence.
And here's another thing. My understanding is not everybody agrees on this, but today I do. So, but there's a statement in Revelation 13:3 that he will suffer a mortal head wound. A mortal head wound. And come back. And it'll be healed. So if he's the Antichrist, if he is the Christ imitator, suffering and dying and then coming back would be a very effective way to gain a following. So this coming world leader, this is kind of a picture. We'll talk next time about what he does and how he plays out. But so I want to lay out that the Antichrist, you hear, even the world knows about him. He comes along at the beginning of the tribulation. But that's the point. In 2 Thessalonians, we're saying, Paul comforts the Thessalonians. Do you know who the Antichrist is? And they would have to say no. Then it's not, you're not in the tribulation. You'll know who he is in the day of the Lord. Yep.
You know, there might be a connection here, too, with the access to resources using Hitler as a reference. I understand, my understanding is Germany was set upon two belts, a belt of coal and a belt of iron, and they used the coal to smelter the iron. And Hitler laid down thousands of miles of railroad tracks throughout Europe for, you know, even to Auschwitz and the rest of the places. And, of course, aircraft and everything else. So they had a lot of resources available to them to build up this thing. Apparently he knew something about that. So I would think the Antichrist at that time was going to have some access and control of resources, energy and metals and things like that to carry on board.
I did not know about this idea that Hitler had a, you know, that Germany had the iron and the coal.
Right.
And that makes sense because that's huge, important assets.
Right.
And so you're right. So the Antichrist will probably be a master of knowing how to tap into resources.
Exactly.
Whether that means seizing them, finding them. And he's going to have demonic assistance. So he gets an incredible advantage there. So this tremendously evil person is coming up, will be incredibly wise, incredibly winsome, and at first he will say, like, how can you be against this guy? Look at all the good he has done. And so he will win people's trust in that way.
What I was reading recently, you know, even Americans and even British were saying early on in their early 30s, you know, this Hitler guy's a pretty good guy. He's figuring things out. It's kind of hard to imagine people saying that. But there were some people saying, wow, he's good.
The Antichrist will be much more effective like that.
So he's a key figure in biblical prophecy. And we'll come back and pick up there. Okay? Questions? Is it starting to sound familiar and make sense? Question. Yes, sir.
That deadly wound that he receives, when he said deadly, it's a wound that he died from or could have died from?
That's where some would argue, well, he doesn't really die because Satan doesn't have the ability to really raise from the dead. But on the other hand, the Bible says that God will give them over to increasingly seducing deception. It seems to me, again, I'm not going to be dogmatic, but I would have to say it looks to me like he's going to die and be not resurrected, but brought back to life. And I don't know if that's going to be through some apparent medical or some other thing, or even a spiritual thing.
That'd be at the beginning of his reign, though.
Before his really dominant rise to power, he really gets world control at the midpoint. So, I mean, he's still kind of very influential, but so somewhere I would say in that time frame, before the midpoint.
Yes, sir.
This is a little bit unrelated to that, but I understand that the Jewish nation won't start their sacrifices until they find the ancient sacrifice, or the ancient ashes of the red heifer, and they mix them together with the new or something. There's some key element there, I've heard, that they, if they find these ashes, or the alleged ashes they think are the old red heifer ashes, that they will start sacrifices right away and continue on whether the temple is built or not.
Yeah, so there is some discussion. For ritual purification, you need water that has the ashes of a red heifer mixed in. And so there apparently is a pot of red heifer ashes smuggled away somewhere that they're hoping to find. So again, an antichrist that could find that. Or again, one of the other options is, you know, that a red heifer is actually raised, which hasn't fully been accomplished yet.
There was a fellow, I think, in Mississippi many years ago. His name was Clyde Loat, and he had was developing a red heifer, and it was almost perfect or something. He was in the process of doing that for the Jewish nation.
And there was an archaeologist back in the 80s, 70s and 80s, who was kind of an amateur archaeologist, a guy who was really working at trying to figure out where those ashes of the red heifer were. That was... And probably, you know, so you're right. If the Antichrist could come up with an answer to that solution and solve some of these problems. All right. Well, let's find out how we can